Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the bubble quake when we come back. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock, made in Japan, for 6 a.m. While his coffee pot, made in Japan, is perking, he puts on his blow dryer, made in Taiwan, to work, and then he shaves with an electric razor made in Hong Kong. Then he puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet, made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, made in Mexico, how much money he can spend today. Then after setting his watch, made in Switzerland, to the radio, made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car, made in Germany, then goes looking, as he has for many months now, for a good-paying American job. Then, at the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, and then turns on his TV made in Japan, and then wonders why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of private business, call us now at the law school and order my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, it's free of charge. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative and entertaining. It's educational. And best of all, it's free. Remember, call now, the number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about bubble quake, the impending collapse of the world's economies. President Bush, not too long ago, while he was commenting on that $800 billion a year balance of payments deficit, said it is not sustainable. Indeed, it's not sustainable, but when we hear mainstream politicians and economists tell us that our economy is unsustainable, that should be big news, because over the last 30 or 40 years, and I can remember as a child, my granddad, while commenting on the national debt in 1950, which stood at $257 billion, he said, "This is unsustainable, this cannot go on." That was 1950. My God, wouldn't he be amazed today if he could see the national debt stand at $8 trillion and growing? I think he'd be amazed. I'm amazed. I didn't think it could get that high. Well, not before we had the big one. Now, we had the big one in 1929 through 1937. It was called the Great Depression. Depressions and recessions have been going on in our history throughout the ages for thousands of years. It isn't something that just came upon us, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years because of Bill Clinton and George Bush. It's something that's been around for a long time. The Federal Reserve was created back in 1913 for the express purpose of eliminating these cycles of boom and bust. That was their job. They haven't done it. And they didn't do it prior to the Federal Reserve in any country in history. But America now holds the record. We Americans can now claim the longest period of sustained, continual growth under a fiat paper money system in the history of the world. We are the champions. And as a result of that 90 years of paper money, which has now become fiat paper money, we're now going into a period of experience called hyperinflation. We did that back in the 1780s during the Revolutionary War. We needed to finance the war, so we just printed money to do it. Today, we need to finance the Iraq War, so we're just printing the money to do it. Well, in 1783, when the British surrendered, the American economy was in shambles, and the American economy collapsed. And John Adams said that money was as plenty as oak leaves. As plentiful as oak leaves. Sailors who were paid off in this continental currency in the 1780s would ingest and have a tailor sew the bills together to make them a suit so they could walk down the street wearing their money. That's how worthless it had become. Then our founding fathers in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention. I remember this is just 5 or 6 years later, you know. Here comes the Constitution of the United States. So they wrote in a clause at Article 1, Section 10, 17 words that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And they believed at the time, George Marshall did anyway, that they had eliminated paper money from the American economy forever. They put it right in the Constitution. But boys and girls, paper money, unjust weights and balances, is so ingrained in human nature and greed, just vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, the motivators of human nature, that we were just bound and determined that in spite of that constitutional prohibition against paper money, which was the design, which was the intent, in 1794 we created a U.S. National Bank, or 1796. Now, this was a private bank, and they went out and they printed paper money. And this private bank, along with the United States Treasury putting out gold coin, went into operation. And so we started into these boom and bust cycles. Andrew Jackson, in 1836, vetoed the reenactment of the U.S. National Bank Charter. It had a 20-year charter, and it was renewed in 1816. And then it was up for renewal in 1836, and Andrew Jackson, he said, nope, we're not going to have that, and so he vetoed it. So from 1836 to the Civil War, we didn't have paper money. And then because of the need of the Yankees in the North, and of course the Southerners in the South, they printed paper money. Both sides printed paper money to finance the war. And so we had a period of private banking and the U.S. Treasury printing paper money, and then the Treasury quit printing paper money. And then in 1913, because we'd been through several of these boom and bust cycles, again caused by the paper money, we decided that we needed a solution to this. So instead of doing what we did back in 1787, eliminating paper money, we institutionalized it with this Federal Reserve. And so the Federal Reserve ran us into bankruptcy in 1929. So by 1933, we had to raise the price of gold from $20 to $35. Now the price of gold is around $600. And the buying power of a dollar, which had remained fairly stable from 1787 through 1933, has now lost 98% of its purchasing power. As we speak now in 2007, 98 cents has disappeared. The American dollar is now worth 2 cents compared to 1930 or 1787 or 1860. And we're headed into a period of hyperinflation. And this hyperinflation could amount to as much as 5,000% a year. 5,000%. It'll go up by 5 times or 50 times. 50 times. Now think of that. Just think of your money deteriorating in value by multiple times per year. Now try to conduct your business doing that. Now we've been warned, we've been told, but you know, warnings and history has never deterred human beings from making all of the worst possible mistakes that they could. We lived through the Great Depression within my lifetime, but we didn't learn anything from it. and we're headed into the same abyss that we did in the 1920s. We can call the 90s the boom times before the bust, just like we did the 20s were the boom times before the bust in the 1930s. And as we sit on the precipice, it's no longer just the right-wing reactionary, nutcases, out here that are crying gloom and doom. Now, we're getting the mainstream economists and politicians like Alan Greenspan, who is the architect of this modern bust back in the 1980s and 90s when he was the Fed chairman. He's the one that created all this money and fed these bubbles that finally collapsed in 2000 and then reinflated from 2000 to 2006. And then he left office, and a new guy, they call him Helicopter Ben. Helicopter Ben Bernanke now is the new Fed chairman. And his famous statement was, if necessary to maintain liquidity, we will drop money out of helicopters. If you wanted to get rich, if the government was serious about eliminating poverty in America, why don't they just print up $1 million for every man, woman, and child in America? That'd be 300 million piles of $1 million bills, and we'll just pass them out. And everybody in America will be a millionaire overnight. Wouldn't you just love that? But what would that do to prices, and what would that do to the economy? Well, first of all, millionaires don't work. So the first thing I'm going to do is quit my job, because now I've got $1 million. I'll just sit back and spend money and have a good time. And I think that most of you will do the same thing. That means that all production stops immediately. So you can see that excessive money in the economy encourages consumption, because we're all going down to Battlefield Mall and spend our money and have a good time. And it is a deterrent to production. And as you take a look at the American economy today compared to 1960, 60% of the American economy was in production called manufacturing. Today it's down to about 13%. So our productive capacity has left our shores and it has gone to foreign countries. And so now today, in 2007, 99% of shoes sold in the United States are made overseas. 1% are made in the United States. When I was a kid, we made 100% of our shoes in the United States and exported our shoes all around the world, and people around the world wore American shoes. Today we wear Chinese and Philippine shoes, and they're made someplace else. And it's not just shoes, it's big screen TVs and it's automobiles. It's everything that we consume here in America is being made overseas. And this is called globalization. It's the prelude to the New World Order. And people around the world love it. They love it. Americans, who are getting screwed the worst by the offshoring of our jobs and our industries overseas, have not risen up and rioted in the streets. They passively walk around scratching their heads saying, oh my God, what's going on here? And that in part is caused by being educated in public school, because in your mind, your mindset says that free trade and globalization is good for America and good for the world. You've been told that over and over again. You actually believe that. While your employment has been exported, I remember a few years ago, Ted Kennedy really chastised and castigated the Stanley Tool Company for moving their operations out of the United States, because the Stanley Tool Company is from New England. I don't know if they're in Massachusetts or Connecticut, but Stanley Tools, for those of you around the world, in this country, in the United States, was the bellwether, the standard for tool making. They made tapes and squares and all kinds of hand tools for carpenters and plumbers, electricians, and people like that. And if it had the name Stanley on it, you were using the Cadillac, the number one tool that you could buy. It wasn't some cheap piece of trash made in Japan or China. It was the tool to have. And of course, it had a price commensurate with it. It was the most expensive tool you could buy. Some years ago, I was over in the Ace Hardware store, and I saw contractors' tapes, which Stanley tapes at that time were selling for around $8 to $12. And I saw this tape for $3 and change, less than $4. which is half price or one-third the price of a Stanley tape. And I looked at it, $4, because I hadn't seen a $4 25-foot contractor's tape for a long time, many years. And I picked it up, and I looked at it, and I saw it was made in China. And I thought to myself, I said, oh, my God, is this a piece of trash? And I pulled it out, and I looked at it, and I said, my God, this thing looks like a Stanley. Hell, it might have been a Stanley made in China, but it didn't have a Stanley brand on it. It was China, made in China. And it wasn't long after that that the Stanley Tool Company moved their operations offshore, and Ted Kennedy, he was just livid. He said, they're un-American, and they're this and that and another thing. But, boys and girls, let me ask you this. Let's suppose that you had a choice to make. And you go out here, and you want to buy this tape measure. You have a need for a tape measure. And over here is a Stanley tape measure, and it's $12. And over here on your right side, there's a Chinese tape measure, and you can't tell the difference. They're colored the same, and they look about the same, and it's $4. Now, which tape are you going to buy? Well, if you're like I am, you're going to buy that $4 tape. Now, the worker that's making that Stanley tape, he's making $15 or $20 an hour, see? And the guy that's making this $4 tape, he's working for maybe 15 cents an hour in China. And so they can make that tape over in China for $2 and sell it in this country for $4 and double their money. And the Stanley people can make that tape for $6 and sell it for $12 and double their money. Who are you going to support, the Chinese guy over in China or the American guy in Connecticut? And the answer is, over time, you're going to support the Chinese guy. And that's what free trade is all about. And so the free trade guys say, but look, when you go to buy that tape, instead of having to pay $12, you can get it for $4. And look, you're saving $8. And so that's true. And I saved $8 and I bought that American tape. Now, I'm an American and I sell my products. And the products that I sell, the Chinese don't buy. Like I sell Family Milk cows. And I have a product and I sell my Family Milk cows, and I have to sell those to Americans. Now, Americans cannot afford the milk cows because they're no longer employed. I don't know what those guys in Connecticut that used to work for Stanley are doing now. But they're not making the wages that they were making. They're now working in some service industry. And the manufacturing jobs, which we used to have 60% of our economy based upon manufacturing and exports and so on, is now down to 13%. So somewhere between that 13 and 60, all those Americans now are doing something else. And instead of making the big money, they're now making service industry money. And so they can't afford to buy my milk cows. And that's how it impacts upon me. So it would have made more sense for us to buy the $12 tape and support our Stanley guys, because the Stanley guy might have bought my milk cow. But I can guarantee you that nobody in China is going to buy one of my milk cows. And so we have run up this humongous balance of payments deficit. We Americans manufacture, we make, we have raw materials, and we export about $200 billion a year. So put that number 2 in your brain there, in your little computer. And then we buy now, see, we buy our tapes and we buy our big screen TVs and our shoes from the Chinese, who can make them cheaper than we can here in America. And they're selling us, the Chinese and Japanese and Formosans, everybody else, they're selling us $800 billion. So we're buying 8 and selling 2. That's a deficit or difference of 6. And so we Americans over here are consuming about 75% more than we make. And that's wonderful for consumption. It's wonderful for our standard of living and for our inflation index. But how long can that go on? And so our president, not too long ago, said it's unsustainable. That's your president, George Bush. And he, along with a whole host and plethora of other economists and politicians, are telling us the same thing. It's not just the balance of payments deficit, but it's also the debt load that we Americans are carrying. That's unsustainable. We can't continue that on forever. And the rate by which we're expanding our debt, which is greater than our production. So we're making $10,000 a year and spending $11,000 or $12,000. And, you know, that can go on for a while you're consuming your equity. But, you know, there comes a point in time when that won't go on either. We saw that in Argentina in 2001. We saw that here in America in 1929, 1922, 1907. I mean, you know, this boom and bust cycle has been going on for a long time. Some of these boom and bust cycles get to be pretty humongous. The 1930s was a humongous bust. And all of the prognosticators tell us that the next bust is going to make the last one, the 1930s depression, looked like a cakewalk by comparison, because the excesses that we are now involved in are so much greater than they were back in the 1930s. You see, America, our nation, our national government didn't have an $8 trillion national debt. It was only $2 billion back in 1930. So we had lots of credit. Americans didn't have this massive credit card debt and mortgage debt that they have today, so they could borrow money. Things were a lot different back then than they are this time around. So the excesses that we see today were so much greater, or are so much greater than they were back in the 30s, that they say, well, we can expect this to get even worse. So a fellow by the name of Wiedemeyer wrote a book here called "The America's Bubble Economy," the bubble quake, as he calls it. And I've been reporting to you on that book, giving you some facts and figures and giving you some ideas as to what you can do. And so he points out that the capital goods sector of our economy, which is about 25% of the economic activity in the country, capital goods, those are the people, and the carpenters, plumbers, and electricians that are building your houses out here, that is fueling the real estate bubble. The people that are manufacturing your automobiles, the people that work in Detroit that are making those Fords and those SUVs and so on, those are called capital goods. And that section, or that portion of the economy, he says, is going to be decimated. And then 35% of the economy is made up of discretionary spending. That's where you take your money down to the mall and you buy a big screen TV, or you buy shoes, or Gucci this and Gucci that, you know. You buy these designer jeans and things. That's called discretionary spending. You can buy it, or you can leave it alone. And that's 35%. So 25 and 35% will be decimated, because when you lose your job and you're on unemployment insurance, you'll probably be thinking more in line with Levi's rather than Jordache or something, you know. Now, if you take a look at the pictures of the old-timers back in the 1930s, they were all wearing, and I remember as a kid, all of the boys and, well, not the girls, but all the boys wore tennis shoes, those cheap John tennis shoes, and bib overalls. And if you were a wealthy kid, I was in the wealthy class of kids, and we didn't wear the cheap tennis shoes. We wore high-top Buster Brown shoes. So I was in the top 400, and so therefore I wore the Buster Browns and bib overalls, but we weren't wearing the kinds of clothes that we wear today. And people didn't buy new clothes. Women would buy flour in sacks, and then they would use the sack to make dresses with. They actually took the sack and made dresses. It wasn't burlap, you know. They made flour sacks out of you know, regular dress making material. I don't know what you call it, but that's what people were doing. They sewed their own clothes at home. This is what they did. At least the women did. Now men pretty much bought their clothes, but they bought the cheap clothes. They bought denim, and they bought bib overalls, and they weren't wasting their money. Now today we're living in a very affluent society. We've had a lot of money. We've been living the high life, you know, for many years, especially since World War II. And for Americans today to take this kind of a hit is going to be very traumatic. those of us that lived through it, or at least lived in the aftermath of it, and had it explained to us, because when I was a kid and I went to school, we had a pair of shoes that you wore to school, and then when you came home from school, you took those off, and then you wore your play shoes. There wasn't any waste. We consumed and used everything. Today, we throw things away. My wife goes down to the thrift shop every now and again, and what people discard, what they give away to Salvation Army and St. Vincent de Paul, is better stuff than we ever had when I was a kid. So Americans today throw away better materials, better goods than I had as a child growing up. So for me, when this thing turns turtle, I've already been down that road, so all I'm doing is going back down a road that I've already been on. For those of you that have never been on that road, it's going to be a bitter pill. A very bitter pill. Which is why I suggest that you start thinking about that today so that you can ameliorate or lessen the impact of this hit that we're all going to take. I'm going to take the hit just like everybody else. I'm not immune, you know, from depressions or wars or upsets or tornadoes or anything else. But I'm maybe a little better prepared for it. So this is one of those books that I review from time to time that says, well, the chapter I'm looking at here says survive and thrive. Survive and thrive. And one of the points that he makes over here is that there's big opportunities after the bubbles pop, cashing in on distressed assets. Cashing in on distressed assets. I told you about old Frank Rocha, you know, who had 650 tons of hay sitting in his barn when the neighbor came over and said, Frank, I'm out of hay. Please sell me some hay. And old Frank said, I'm getting hay to sell. I thought it was pretty rude on his part, and I thought it was pretty self-serving. But old Frank wasn't a communist, and he wasn't in the business of sharing and sharing alike. He had never been a child in America. He was a Portuguese fella from the Azores, came to America in 1922, and he was a capitalist through and through. He provided for himself. He was independent. He didn't ask anybody for anything, but then he wasn't there to give anybody anything either. And the neighbor was really distraught, really distraught. And I was distraught. I was a communist. I'd been raised in the public school system, and I'd been trained in communism, you know, share and share alike, from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And as a young communist, I didn't understand why Frank wouldn't share and share alike. But he said, I got to take care of my own cows. I got to take care of my own business. I'm not wishing this guy any bad luck, but he should have taken care of himself. Now, the other day, I got to give you a little story here. I was watching TV here last night, and I noticed up in Springfield, we just had a bad ice storm. And they've got shelters opened up here in Springfield, and they got people in these shelters over here because they're without electric power. And the last time we had an outage of electric power, I remember here on the ranch, was 1987, and we were out of power for 7 days. And that meant I didn't have any water here for 7 days. I didn't have any pump. Our water comes out of a well, and we couldn't pump water. Now, I survived that, and I lived through that period of no water for 7 days, and it was a problem, and I lived through it, and I said to myself, well, what if we didn't have power here for 30 days or 90 days or a year? What if the power went off and didn't come back on? I said, I'd be in a world of hurt. I couldn't live here without power. I couldn't live here without that. Well, I've got to solve that problem. So I went to work, and I solved my water problem. I prepared for the future. And I have a water system now that when the power goes off for a week or two or three, I don't care. I can live through that. In fact, there was life here before there was electricity, because electricity didn't come in here until 1935. So what happens, America, is that we become dependent upon these new gadgets and innovations. There was life here before electricity. When electricity came in, we drilled wells, and now we depend upon the electricity. Then if a natural event occurs, you know, like an ice storm, and the electricity goes off. We all walk around, you know, with our heads up our you-know-whats, and we don't know what the hell to do next. So I woke up one day and I said, you know, that isn't going to happen to me again. So while I was watching the news, I noticed all these people living in Springfield, living in the city, are going to shelters because they don't have any electricity. And I thought, well, there was life in Springfield in 1850 before they had electricity, and those people didn't go to shelters when they had an ice storm. So that told me that the electricity has made us dependent, not independent. It's made us dependent. We can't live without it. Well, at least 50,000 people can't, because that's how many they say they get in shelters. And there were long lines of people trying to buy kerosene. And I thought to myself, well, gee, you know, last month there was no lines for kerosene, and there was no shortage of kerosene, and there was no rationing of kerosene a month ago, a year ago, or 5 years ago. Why weren't those people buying that kerosene a year ago, a month ago, or 5 years ago? Why didn't they have a kerosene stock? I have one. I have kerosene over here in case the power goes off so that I can power my kerosene lights and lanterns and heaters. And that's because we've been through that once before, and ice storms are not something new here. This is Missouri. It snows here. This is the Midwest, and we have bad storms and bad weather here. And in the old days, we used to be prepared for that. Every individual family would have kerosene. They'd have a 50-gallon barrel, and they'd have kerosene in it. They'd have some heaters and lamps. We have a cubicle over here that we have candles in, a little storage space where we have candles and kerosene lanterns and stuff. Now, boys and girls, I want to tell you, I don't like kerosene light, and I don't like candlelight, but it's better than dark. It's not as good as a 100-watt light bulb, but it's better than dark. And so, when there is no electricity, well, then we go back to what worked. What is it that we were doing 50 or 100 years ago that we could live our lives here in Missouri without electricity? And whatever that is, we should be prepared for it. 50,000 people in Springfield should have had some kerosene in their garage. They should have had some candles. They should have had some sleeping bags. Now, let me ask you this. These people don't have electricity, so they don't have heat. How were these people heating their homes in 1900 before they had electricity? Well, they heated their homes with wood. Or they might not have heated their whole house to 68 or 75 degrees with gas heat or with electric heat or with oil heat, but they had some heat. Now, in the old days, they used to heat a room. We had a stove in the kitchen, and then you dressed for bed in the kitchen, then you walk down this hall. The rest of the house might be 0 or 10 above, and you wore your night clothes, and then you went and got in bed. Now, when you go to the Arctic or the Antarctic, you know, they don't have electricity, you know, out there, and they don't have, when they're making these treks across the ice, they sleep in their sleeping bags. And so we have sleeping bags here stockpiled for every member of the family that'll take us down to 20 degrees below zero, so that if the power goes off and we don't have any heat, we don't have any wood, we will climb into our sleeping bags just like you do in Alaska or the North Pole, and we will survive it. I don't need a shelter. But I want to point out, boys and girls, that Americans no longer think like that because we have grown soft, weak. America's women today, 35% of them, when they have a baby, have a cesarean section. Having a baby in America today is a medical emergency. We have to have an ambulance to haul you off to the hospital, ladies. Now go back to Exodus chapter 1, and you'll see that these midwives explain to the Pharaoh that these Israelite women are so tough that by the time the midwife gets there, the baby's already born. You know, there was a time in America when we were competent, self-sufficient, self-reliant. Something's happened here in America, and I would suggest that in the last 2 years of the boom cycle, or three or five, whatever we have left, that we stockpile a little kerosene, don't you? Maybe we ought to have some candles stashed away so that when the power goes off, the candlelight is a little better than the dark. Maybe we ought to have a sleeping bag just in case there's no heat. And maybe there's no shelter. What do you think about that? And let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. They're free. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or those publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily wholly endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing a book called The America's Bubble Economy, written by David Wiedemeyer. I think it's Wiedemeyer. It might be Wiedemeyer also, or Wiedemeyer. It's spelled Wiedemeyer, America's Bubble Economy. It's a new book. In fact, it just came out in 2006. Got it at Barnes & Noble. And it's not quite the gloom and doom book that you read so much about from the right-wing reactionary conservatives, you know, that you hear me cite from time to time. This guy's a mainstream economist. And like George Bush, he says, hey, listen, this thing's unsustainable, and it's inevitably going to collapse. He isn't putting any dates on it. He thinks that from 2006, you've got 2 to 5 years. 2 to 5 years. I'd be surprised if you had 2 to 5 months. 2 to 5 months. But, you know, I'm not a prophet, and God doesn't talk to me directly. You know, I can read the Bible like everybody else, but unlike some people who have revelations, our president, I understand, is getting revelations now directly from God, and I sometimes wonder which one. But nevertheless, I don't get any of these direct revelations from God, and so all I know is what I read in the papers, as old Will Rogers said. But what I'm reading in the papers leads me to believe that we're headed for some tough times. Now, I lived through these tough times in the past. I worked at Frank Roach's Frank Rocha had the toughest place to work on in the Eel River Valley in 1955. In fact, when I was going in for my job interview with old Frank in 1955, I was walking down Lighthouse Road. And I didn't know where Rocha's place was, and so I got off the bus in Lolita, and I'm walking down this road. It was a couple of miles from Lolita down here to Frank's place, and went by Walter Bugnuden. He was out in the front yard cutting the grass with a scythe. You know, in the old days before we had lawn mowers and all this fancy equipment, you know, we used to cut our grass. We had grass cutting equipment, and it was called a scythe. And so you went out there with a scythe and you cut it by hand. And old Walt, he was out there cutting the grass. And so I stopped and I asked him for directions. I said, "I'm looking for Frank Roach's place. Can you tell me how far I've got to walk yet?" And I was just a young punk kid, you know, 15 years old, out of the city, out of Eureka, California. And old Bugnuda looked at me and he sized me up and he said, "Why do you want to know?" I said, "Well, I'm looking for a job." And I was at Bud Clark's employment agency, and he sent me out here for a job as a milker over here at Roach's. And Bug Nuda said, he looked at me, no punk kid, you know. And he said, "Have you ever worked on a ranch before?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, have you ever milked cows before?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You ever worked with horses before?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Son, you might as well just walk on back and catch the next bus back." He said, "You're not going to make it down there at Roach's." I was absolutely devastated. I was dumbfounded. I was looking for a job. Summer job, you know, in high school. And so I thanked him, and I walked on down to Roach's. And as it turned out, I did get a job there, and he did hire me. He didn't pay me what the job advertised because I didn't have the skills involved. But, you know, I worked there for a while, and this was the worst place in the valley. Bug Nuda told me, he said, "That's the toughest place in the valley to work. Rocha is still farming with horses." This was 1955, and there was only two guys in the valley still had horses. That was Rocha and old John Enos. And, you know, that's why he asked me. He said, "You ever work with horses?" "No." "Hell, today, kids, the only place you could get that kind of experience would be with the Amish. I mean, the Amish, you know, they still know how to work. The rest of us over here couldn't make it on an Amish farm. If you're the average Joe six-pack farmer today and you went to work on an Amish farm, you wouldn't last a week." And this guy, Bugnuda, told me, he said, "You're not going to last a week down there, kid." And well, I went down there. I lasted for 3 years. And I guess he kind of steeled me up. I said, "Well, by God, I'm not going to fail. I'm going down there. I'm going to make it." Now, I left Roach's, the toughest place in the valley to work, and I went over to Bill Trutelli's. Now, Trutelli had everything that you could imagine. Well, he had hydraulic lifts on his tractors. He had electric elevators to move hay. He had tractors and wagons and pipelines and bulk tanks. And my God, he just had everything. It was the easiest place in the valley to work. I went from the toughest place to the easiest place. Now, you know, a lot of people, you know, they come out of high school and they go to work in the easy places. And then when things get a little tough, you know, they don't know how to handle that. I started out in the toughest place in the valley. Boys and girls, for me, life has been downhill. It's been a joy. It's been a pleasure ever since. I got broke in the right place. You can't make it any tougher than Frank Roach's, and I already made the Rocha trip. Hell, you can't bury me now. But if I'd have started over at Bill Trutelli's and then went over to Roach's, I never would have made it. And that's what old Bugnuda was trying to tell me. And Americans are in that boat. You know, most of you people are born in the city, and you've lived in the city all of your lives. You've had cement under your feet. You don't know what the hell mud is. The old-timers that lived through the Great Depression, it was tough. And they all told us how tough it was. But, you know, those guys lived through it. And old Frank Rocha gave me a little piece of advice one time. He said to me, he said, "Son, I came from the Azores, where it is really tough. where the unemployment rate is around a third, where you have to work hard just to get enough food to eat. I never had shoes until I was 17 years old. Old Frank taught me how to bind my feet in burlap. That's what those people wear on their feet, is burlap sacks. So I learned how to live my life without shoes. I said, well, show me how to bind my feet. Chinese used to use bindings. You know, people before they had shoes went barefoot, and then when they got a little bit up in the world, you know, they'd bind their feet. So I learned how to bind my feet so that I could get my feet up off the ground. You know, at least I'd be wearing something. And it made me appreciate shoes. And so the other day I told the wife, I said, she happened to be over in the thrift store, and there's about, I don't know, 30, 40 pairs of shoes sitting in there in the thrift shop. Shoes that people had thrown away. And I looked at those shoes and I said, my God, those shoes are better than what I had in 1944 when my shoes wore out and I was running barefoot for the last 6 weeks until the ration cards came out. So a kid that goes barefoot, you know, once in his life and finds out what life is like without shoes, kind of appreciates shoes. I don't think Americans appreciate shoes. I don't think they've ever been barefoot. I was once. So I said to the wife, I think you ought to buy all those shoes and just put them in a container. We'll need them. Or there will be other people that need them. You know, just because I've got 10 or 15 pairs of shoes that don't fit me doesn't mean that there isn't 10 or 15 pairs of shoes that won't fit somebody else. And you know, we Americans are pretty wasteful people. I think that's going to come to an end. So I thought I would share with you this book on the bubble quake so that you'd have an opportunity that when you're barefoot, you'll know why. That when you don't have a job and you can't pay the rent and you lose your house, you'll know why. And it's because of the excesses over the last 50 years. You get excessive and then you forget that, you know, there's a real world out there. And that's what's happened to the people up in Springfield. There's an ice storm came through, nothing big. It's the worst ice storm in history. That's true. It's the worst ice storm in history, but it's not the first ice storm. And we've had ice storms before. And if we've had ice storms before, then you should be prepared. Now, when I lived through mine and I was without water, you know, without electricity for a week, I said, that isn't going to happen to me again. I'm going to have some candles. I'm going to have some kerosene. I'm going to have some sleeping bags. I'm going to prepare for this water shortage, and I'm going to prepare for this power outage. And I did. When it happens here, I'm not going to a shelter. In 1924, when there was an ice storm and there wasn't any power here to start with, old Joe Hurd and May Hurd up here, they didn't go to a shelter because there was an ice storm in 1924. People didn't go to shelters in 1850 because there was a snowstorm or an ice storm. You hunkered down. And you took care of yourself, because if you had any moxie between your ears, you had prepared for these kinds of events. They don't happen often. You don't have a Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans very often. But you can rest assured, boys and girls, that over the next 20 years, the people of New Orleans will have forgotten about Hurricane Katrina. They will have rebuilt the city, and they will forget all about it. They will not be prepared for the next Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans any better than they were for the last one. So they didn't need to make any preparations, and they don't need to learn from history. They don't need to be told about Hurricane Katrina. They're not going to learn anything from it anyway. Why do you need to talk about something that's unpleasant if you can't learn from it? Now, Americans did not learn from the Great Depression. At least it hasn't affected anybody in 2007. Well, not very many. There might be a few of you out there that are paying attention, but by and large, it isn't going to affect very many people. Now, I'm an old man, and I can remember back in the days when we didn't have it, and so I'm sitting here saying, well, if I had to live through it again, I've done without them. I'll probably do without again in the future. But it's going to be an awful shock for somebody that's never done without, never been without. And that's what's happening up in Springfield. These people haven't been without power. They know what the hell to do next. They don't have sleeping bags. They got these news people running around here. Got some young woman, you know, about 20 years old, 25 maybe. and she's out interviewing people, you know, for the 6 o'clock news. And so she goes over and she finds some lady, and she says, "Well, tell us how is it without power? You've been without power now for 3 days." "Oh, I just don't know what I'm going to do. We don't have any power, and we have an electric stove, and we can't cook." And well, that's true. You know, you live your life years and years and years, and you've and when the power goes out, it's out for 4 or 5 hours, and it comes back on. Wow, God, we were without power for 5 hours. Now, the power, they tell us, is going to be off for 3 weeks, and these people, they don't have any heat because, you know, they've got gas in their house, and it's a gas furnace, and they've got to have a blower, and there's no electric. They're selling generators up here in Springfield by the truckloads. Home Depot is expecting a truckload in. They're selling $1,200 generators, and people are lined up, and they've got numbers from 1 to 138. They showed it on the news last night. This guy's got number 138, and he said, "This is a hell of a lot better having..." No, he had number 50. He said, "It's a lot better having number 50 than number 138, which was the last guy in line at the Home Depot. And they're standing in line to get their orders in for generators. My question is, well, there wasn't any shortage of generators last month. Why didn't you go buy a generator last month in anticipation of an ice storm that's going to happen in the future? Let me make a prediction. We had the worst ice storm in the history of the Ozarks in January of 2007. My God, do you people believe this is the last ice storm that's ever going to hit the Ozarks for all the rest of time? Don't you believe that there's going to be another ice storm next year, 5 years or 10 years from now? Don't you think you ought to be prepared for the next ice storm, since how you weren't prepared for this one? Don't you people in New Orleans think that you ought to be prepared for the next Hurricane Katrina? If you can get one in 2005, can't you get another one in 2010, 15, 20, or 25? How about you people down in Galveston? You had one down near 1900. But you know, from 1900 on, you haven't had any bad hurricane down there, now have you? So what happens if you have one next year or the year after, 5 years from now? Are you people going to learn from the hurricane of 1900? Hell no. They're not going to learn from that. My God, that was 100 years ago. That was back in the Dark Ages. Killed 6,000 people down there. Six times as many as it killed down there in New Orleans. And they didn't have FEMA down there to get in their way either. They probably fared out better without the federal government getting in the road. But anyway, I just share that with you because in economics, this is what's coming. And, you know, many of us have been waiting for it for years and years. We've had depressions and recessions before, and there will be depressions and recessions in the future. And it would be good for you, in my view, if you were prepared a little better for the next one. And so this guy is helping you do that. And so I wanted to share that with you. You can get a copy of this book. And it's America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops. And he says there's big opportunities after the bubbles pop, cashing in on the distressed assets. And that's what I intend to do. I intend to cash in on distressed assets and make a profit off of your misery. And that's because if you haven't got the foresight to protect your assets and your property, you're going to lose it anyway. So what the hell difference does it make to you whether I benefit from it or somebody else? Because you're going to lose it. You're not going to benefit from it. You haven't got the foresight to protect your assets from the bubble quake. So there's going to be a massive transfer of wealth. There was a massive transfer of wealth in 1907 here in America in that depression. There was a massive transfer of wealth in 1921-22 in that depression. There was a massive transfer of wealth in 1929 to 37 in that depression. And there were losers and there were winners. So I've been looking at the winners and the losers, and I decided that I wanted to be one of the winners. So I positioned myself to do that. Now this guy, David Wiedemeyer, is doing the same thing. He's positioning himself to benefit from and to profit from the next Great Depression. So I said, well, my gosh, if this guy can do that, can I do that? So he has some very simple, straightforward, common sense remedies and solutions. He says, if you're involved in one of these businesses or enterprises that historically in the past has been a loser. Why don't you position yourself for the future in a position where you can prosper? So get out of capital goods and discretionary industries and get into the necessities side, and you'll do better. So if you're a carpenter, plumber, or an electrician, and building is going to go down, and you're going to become unemployed, you need to start doing something right now to protect yourself from the unemployment that's coming. So why don't you position yourself in repairs, which is a necessity, rather than new construction, which is a capital good or a discretionary side of the coin. And if you position yourself now, for instance, if you've got a house and you've got $100,000 equity in your house and you sell it today, or you refinance it and you take all of your equity out of it, put it into gold and bury it in a hole in the ground, and let the bank take the house, you can come back later and buy that same house at the same auction when it's in distressed condition from the bank for 10 cents on the dollar. So you got a $200,000 house, you got $100,000 equity, you sell the house, you take the $100,000, pass the old maid on to the next guy. Well, somebody has to lose, kids. And it's either the bank's going to lose, or somebody else is going to lose, or you're going to lose. And if there's any losers around here, I'd rather it be you than me. I mean, if we got to pick losers, I just assume you be the loser and I be the winner. Now, there's a possibility that you and I could both be winners, but, you know, if we have to make any choices, you make your choice and let me make mine. So I just throw that out there for your consideration. Now, houses that were selling when I was in the contracting business back in the 70s, houses were $35,000. Today, they're $350,000. Well, that $350,000 house is going back to its mean. Then its mean is $35,000, and it's going back to $35,000. So I think I'd just soon get out of that $350,000 house today, take my equity out, and wait until this thing bottoms out, and I'll come back and buy that house and maybe two or three more like it for $35,000. And I will prosper. I will benefit from somebody else's misery. It's the way life is. It's the way life is. And if you don't want to do that, well, that's fine. Get in line to be one of the losers. And then when you lose, at least you'll know why. At least when the power goes off and you don't have any candles, you don't have any kerosene, you don't have a generator, you can go get in line down at Home Depot. They're expecting another truckload of generators. God, this is good business for Home Depot. I'm almost envious. They are moving generators out of, you know, Florida and Alabama and all over the country. They're moving them into Springfield, Missouri. They're selling them to people that are standing in line with numbers in their hands. $1,200 a pop. Fast as I can sell them. Because the people were not smart enough to prepare for the ice storm last month, last year, 5 years ago. Let's see if we can get a little better prepared. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. And while I'm thinking about it, I need that Indian black salve. Let me give you one more reminder. If you know where I can get that Indian black salve, let me know, would you? For those of you that know what Indian black salve is. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.